Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints opposes Utah's medical marijuana ballot initiative, but not the use of the drug under every circumstance. Senator Orrin Hatch responds to news about the guilty plea from President Trump's longstanding personal lawyer Michael Cohen, as well as the conviction of his campaign chairman Paul Manafort. And private meetings held by subcommittees of the Inland Port Authority draw criticism. So just why aren't those meetings held in public? Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune editor-in-chief Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Reporter Taylor Anderson is with us as well. Hello and welcome, Taylor.
Good morning, Roger.
And on the phone from the nation's capital, we've got Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. And Tommy, glad you're with us.
Hey, good morning.
If you have questions about medical marijuana, Utah reaction to the Cohen plea, the Inland Port, or other news from the Salt Lake Tribune, call us at 801-355-8255. You can also post them at sltrib.com. Thomas Burr, news broke this week that the president's lawyer, his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, pleaded guilty to campaign finance violations. He said that he committed these crimes at the president's ordering, and this is because of payoffs to two women who say that they've had affairs with Trump. That came the same day as convictions in the case against his campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. But Cohen, in his plea, directly implicated the president. You wrote about the reaction of some Utah politicians to this, Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch in particular. How did he respond to this news as it broke?
When I have to say that was probably the craziest news day I think I've seen in my life as a reporter. In 20 minutes, the president's former campaign manager and former personal lawyer became felons in the span of 20 minutes. That's pretty amazing. Senator Orrin Hatch, like a lot of Republicans, were obviously caught off guard by this and not really sure how to respond, because these are pretty, you know, big things to happen to any president. And Orrin Hatch, when he was talking to reporters, he called them serious charges that can't be ignored. He said he wasn't happy about it. But he was asked specifically, you know, does this rise to the level of impeachment? And let's remember that Orrin Hatch was one of the leading people pushing for Clinton's impeachment back in 1999 over perjury charges and obstruction of justice, and Hatch was very critical of President Clinton during that time and voted for impeachment. But he says it wasn't just yet, that these haven't risen just yet to the level of getting to that process of impeachment of the president. That kind of signals in some ways that, you know, maybe he'd be open to it, maybe he wouldn't, but he wasn't necessarily that critical of the president as much as he was, we're just starting.
Right. I mean, but what he said, the fact that he was concerned and expressing the kind of sentiments that he was expressing, that does mark a turn in the president's, in the senator's sort of treatment of the president, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Senator Hatch has obviously been very effusive about President Trump. He's said he could be one of the best presidents ever. He's been, highly supportive of his agenda and a defender in many ways, where some Republicans have tried to not necessarily go that far. It was an interesting comment from the senator, and we'll see how this evolves in some ways. But I think, you know, the people I've talked to sense are all, you know, let this process play out. Let's see what happens. They're I think, all on pins and needles in some ways, waiting to see what happens with this, you know, Robert Mueller investigation of the Russia interference, and not sure how to stake out a position, because they don't know what the next news, you know, may bring.
Right. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, editor of the Tribune, I want to bring you in on this. Is this news a turning point in the story of the president? And what I wonder as well is, you know, Trump has maintained a certain level of popularity in Republican Utah. The president is being implicated by his personal lawyer in criminal activity. It's sort of weird to then turn this into a question about support or popularity, but this has to be causing some unease among the president's base, many of whom are here in Utah.
Absolutely. I think that Republicans are sort of soul searching for those who want to look at, I guess, optimistically at the reaction from Senator Hatch. You could say that he's approaching this very cautiously and does want the process to unfold unfettered with Mueller's continued investigations. On the other hand, I think his sort of lukewarm reaction to what are very dramatic events, I mean, undeniably dramatic events, was disappointing to a lot of people in Utah. I don't know, you know, what kind of fallout our delegation will have because of sort of the radio silence from the others in the delegation. Tommy, you may have a better idea. You know, is Lee weighing in on this? He's also going to be evaluating Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court nomination. I mean, are others in the delegation voicing concern about Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort's developments this week?
I think the answer is they're trying to stay as quiet as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
That is on point because they really don't want to have position on this because it could come back to bite them in some ways. And the people I've talked to this week, just looking at the situation, some good Republican friends of mine are not even sure what to say because they're afraid of what comes next. Hmm.
You know, a question that's kind of left open is, can the president himself be indicted? Would special counsel Robert Mueller even do that if he could? All of this might be referred to Congress at some point for, you know, possible impeachment proceedings or not. I don't know. In the meantime, there are midterm elections. And a question that I have is, in Utah, does this register? Does it have an impact on the races that are coming up in November? And Tommy, you could start with Mitt Romney and Jenny Wilson, for example. Romney accepted the president's endorsement. Could that come back to bite him?
Yeah, and that's the tough thing. And I always go back to this same point I've made many, many times, which is everyone hates Congress, but they love their congressman. And how local does this go? Because if you're voting in the I'm going to jump to this, Mia Love versus Ben McAdams, how much does the president weigh in there? Mia Love did not support the president. She didn't vote for him, but she supported his agenda. At least she's voted for him for the same points along the way. How does that play with voters in Utah County, for example? I'm not sure because all politics is local in some ways, but does this change? I don't know. Mitt Romney, accepted Trump's endorsement, but that doesn't mean when Romney spoke out was saying, you know, this is how our justice system works, essentially, that means he's not really going to stand by the president when it comes to his comments about Manafort or Paul Manafort, the former campaign manager, or Michael Cohen.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Tell us your thoughts on what this news means for the midterm elections here in Utah or elsewhere. And Tommy, just thinking about that, I mean, the president is crisscrossing the country in advance of those midterm elections, making campaign appearances on behalf of a variety of candidates. It doesn't look like he's coming here, right?
No, in fact, I talked to a person familiar with the president's thinking the other day, and we were asking about, you know, where is he going to go for campaign travel this fall, and essentially the president has plans to, you know, be in several states. I think I was told, you know, 15 different states or something like that. Utah is not on the list, and clearly it comes down to the fact that President Trump has about a 50% approval rating in Utah, and especially in the 4th District, not necessarily a good rating. I think there's a more people who disapprove of the president than approve of the president there. He may not be the best person to come and stump for Mia Love. They haven't invited him to come. They talked to his campaign spokes manager, Dave Hansen, and he said, well, you know, we haven't asked. but I'm not sure that Mia Love's campaign wants the president to come there. That would actually, could actually be in some ways a detriment to the candidate.
Yeah, I mean, I think all candidates right now, all Republican candidates are, well, I suppose there are certain pockets where he maintains this sort of Teflon coating, but I do think that Republican voters are trying to assess whether or not Trump is a drag on the party or if he's going to help with certain targeted constituencies. In Utah, I don't hear a lot of Trump talk right now, you know, and I think nobody's super embracing him except for Hatch, who is now thinking that these developments this week are certainly questionable, but he's not up for re-election.
Right, right. He has the liberty maybe to be able to say that. Yeah, go ahead, Tommy.
Sorry, I think I'm going to jump back in because Roger, you mentioned the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. These are things Republicans are going to talk about going forward. Right now, the economy is going well. They have now their second pick for the Supreme Court, who's likely to be confirmed, no matter Democrats' objection. They're not going to talk about these other things. They're not going to talk about Russia. They're not going to talk about these things. The going forward is the economy is doing well, Supreme Court nominees, and the idea that if the Democrats get the House, there's going to be impeachment proceedings and how horrible that's going to hurt our country. Those are the things that are going to play in November.
Jennifer, is that more likely to play? Going back to the news of Cohen and these guilty pleas, the guilty plea from the president's personal lawyer, is that story more likely to have an impact in other states than it is here? I mean, is that because of the vastly Republican makeup of the state?
I don't know. I don't know how it's playing outside outside of Utah. Here, I think that Republicans, by and large, are embarrassed by this president, that he would surround himself with such questionable characters, that he sort of flippantly answers, he broke the law 12 years ago, so therefore it doesn't count. You know, some sort of lack of respect for the rule of law, I think, is concerning. But again, I think Tommy's right. It's the economy, stupid.
Yeah. But of course, the laws that are, allegedly being broken are much more recent in these later stories. It's interesting moment to live through. Any final thoughts, you guys, on how, news bombshell after news bombshell from the Mueller investigation might impact the midterms or just the presidency in general?
I think it's really just going to, for me, this week felt different. I don't know if Republicans are responding in a similar fashion, but the revelations, like Tommy said, were pretty shocking, with both the Manafort conviction and the conviction and the Cohen pleading. It was a direct implication on Trump. I mean, he cannot avoid that anymore, and so you can't really turn a blind eye to it. I thought that Trump's response was pretty weak. he wants to brush it off, but I don't know how he can at this point. And it's really going to come down to whether Republicans are willing to step up and use some of their political capital to really talk honestly about this president and his character and whether or not Democratic institutions should be respected.
Tommy, your thoughts? I mean, the Mueller investigation goes forward.
It's one of those we're in a drip, drip, drip situation where we see news every day and we just become accustomed to it. Had you told me 5 years ago that the President of the United States was going to be under a special counsel investigation for possible interference and meddling in the election to get elected,
With Russia, of all places,
yes, with
right?
Russia, exactly. And how many people have been convicted now? We have Manafort convicted, Cohen took a plea deal, Papadopoulos, Gates, Michael Flynn, all these things that have happened, and there's no outrage, and I'm not sure where it doesn't come from. Like, how does this not, if it was Hillary Clinton as president right now, would we see a different situation? I don't know. Also, I'm sorry, Roger, to interrupt real fast, but totally. So we just learned that John McCain is going to stop treatment. Obviously, seeing that you know it's not helping in some ways, so we're looking at John McCain's final days. I just wanted to say that because you know I have deep respect for the senator from Arizona, and that's really sad.
Well, and somebody who has in the past—I mean, you were talking about stepping forward and being critical—who has in the past gone against the wishes of this particular president. And that has been news in and of itself. We need to head to our first break of the show. But Tommy, thanks very much for your coverage of this story. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, the LDS Church, sorry, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, comes out against the medical marijuana ballot initiative slated for your November ballot. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. You might know the actor Rose Byrne from starring in the very serious TV show Damages, or you might know her from the much funnier movie Bridesmaids. Well, Rose Byrne is in a new movie which simultaneously criticizes fandom and tells a beautiful love story at the same time. That is coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 here on Utah Public Radio.
Logic and love aren't exclusive to humans, says writer and naturalist Cy Montgomery.
The idea that animals don't think is insane. A much worse mistake is to think that they don't have thoughts and feelings.
Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. I'm Steve Curwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Sunday morning at 5 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, reporter Taylor Anderson, and Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. You can also post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Taylor Anderson, let's turn now to some evolving coverage on a story that you've been following for a while, which is a proposal to legalize medical marijuana in Utah on a broader scale than it is already allowed. The big news this week is that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is opposed to the initiative as it is written now. Tell us about their opposition and how we learned about it.
Yeah, so earlier this week, we got a heads up that the church for actually several months had been working kind of behind the scenes with supporters. They've been meeting and I think really trying to figure out what their position on this was going to be. For some time, their head lobbyist in Utah, Marty Stevens, he's a former House speaker, he had been working with proponents who were bringing Proposition 2 to try to figure out if they could prevent this from actually hitting the ballot, some sort of a compromise that could have been taken up in the legislature. So it wasn't a do or die with Prop 2 or what would become Proposition 2. It would have been some sort of compromise that had the sign off of proponents. And
when was that happening, that negotiation between the lobbyist, Marty Stevens, and the designers of Prop 2?
Right. The email that we got was from the first week of June. And he mentioned, you know, this is moving rapidly. He also mentioned he was taking a vacation in July, so he needed to, you know, if this was going to get done, they needed to know in early June. Obviously, that didn't happen. And this week, the church formally came out against Proposition 2.
Okay. You know, it wasn't so they formally came out and they said this is something that we can't get behind as it's written now. They also said that they sort of couched that statement in language about not being opposed to medical marijuana per se. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it was members outside of Utah were looking when they heard that there was going to be a statement on this. It was going to be the first policy statement issued by the LDS Church on medical marijuana. It's been legal in 30 other states. There are members in every other state, and they were going to figure out, you know, what is the church's formal position. right now it's been kind of unwritten, unspoken. It's between the bishop, the member, and the Lord. You know, that's how they've treated this. So that's kind of a little bit on shaky ground for some members, and they wanted to see what the church's position was going to be. So when they said, we have no problem with medical marijuana, that was a big deal. The only thing is that they added, we have no problem with medical marijuana as long as it's prescribed by a doctor in dosage form and obtained through a pharmacy. That's not the setup in any state. It's usually much more because of federal regulations. It's a federally illegal plant. It has to go through this private, you know, dispensary setup. So it's you know, you call it medical marijuana. That's why you're using it. But it's a little bit kind of gray area, kind of underground, not totally medical. You get a card through a physician, and then from there, you're kind of on your own with, you know, a bud tender and the people that are working at these dispensaries. So they support it under a framework that doesn't exist yet.
Would that framework have to happen at the federal level? I mean, we're talking about doctors prescribing medication specifically. That's something that isn't happening. You did write about one drug that has been federally approved. They're waiting for a change at the federal level, or do they want to do something just scaled back at the Utah level?
That's a possibility. I mean, the FDA did approve one medication. It's called Epidiolex. GW Pharmaceutical had been rushing it to buy up farmland in Britain and start growing hemp because that's what CBD comes from. So that Epidiolex is, you know, for epilepsy. It's a medication, and it derives from cannabis. Hemp is cannabis, so is marijuana. They're the same plant, but one has THC, the other does not. And so that's slowly happening. There's going to be more coming on the market over time, not quickly. And that is one scenario. The other is, you know, yesterday at their announcement, the LDS Church said, look at this coalition. They added dozens of members from across the board, the PTA, Utah Medical Association, you know, former supporters of the proposition. And they said, let's take this up to the legislature and have them create a new framework that has the sign off of all of us.
Okay, so yeah, I was going to ask, it wasn't just the LDS Church making this statement. They had gathered or increased their coalition in opposition to the to Prop 2.
Yeah, two congressmen, Bishop and Stewart, about a third of the legislature had signed on to show that there was support to actually do this. They barely passed a law in March that legalized medical marijuana for people who had 6 months or less to live, right, or who were expected to die within 6 months. Yesterday was kind of, they didn't say it, but you know, they didn't mention it. So you know they don't consider that a medical marijuana law. They're going to say, let's take two, and if Proposition 2 doesn't pass, then we'll get something through the legislature.
Okay, how were proponents of Prop 2 responding to this new news that a major player in the state, I mean, perhaps the major player in the state, is opposed to what they're trying to do?
I mean, they're a campaign, so you have to keep kind of calm, cool, and collected, you know, and the LDS Church in Utah politics is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. So you have to assume they're going to come in one way or the other. They claimed, the proponents of this claimed that they expected the church to weigh in. They did not expect them to weigh in on their side. And so, you know, they said, no big deal, you know, we'll keep on keeping on. They have good poll numbers, but this is going to have a pretty significant impact, I would imagine.
Jennifer, speaking of polling, has shown strong support in Utah, as Taylor just said, for this. But then just last week on this show, the managing editor of the Tribune, David Noyce, said that it would take the church strongly coming out against this for this proposition to go down. Is that what we're seeing here? Are we going to see now this proposition losing steam and fizzling?
I don't know if it'll fizzle. This is a real complicated one. And in some ways, I find it a litmus test for the church to see what power they really hold over the electorate. As you mentioned, in our last poll with the Hinckley Institute, we saw support for the initiative above 60%. We're not going to do another poll for about another month. So we'll see how this affects how people are feeling about it. Just in anecdotally on my social media, I'm seeing a lot of people who say, I'm a faithful member, I cannot agree with the church on this one because, and again, you know, people have experience with cancer patients or other people with debilitating disease, and they see it firsthand, and they know that cannabis oil or whatever can alleviate some of that pain. So it'll be really, really interesting to see the fallout of this. I don't think that we've seen this strong of a statement from the LDS Church before on a legislative proposal, on an initiative. I will say that proponents were pretty much expecting this. But on the other hand, their retort is, look, the legislature has had the opportunity to create a pathway to legalize medicinal marijuana for 3 or 4 years now. So why should voters trust that legislators are going to take it up now just because the LDS Church has weighed in?
Right. And actually, before we go on to the sort of what comes next. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Tommy Burr. You're jumping.
No, I want to ask Jennifer, but I mean, like, I found this fascinating because the Mormon Church's opposition to same-sex marriage in California with Proposition 8 and how, you know, much they worked to end same-sex marriage there, and the money they poured in and the help they tried to get. I understand, like, this is pretty big in Utah for them to come out on one thing, but they also did say, if I'm correct, that they're okay with medicinal use of marijuana. They're just not for this initiative. Am I right there?
Well, according to the statement, there is that additional conditional clause. If it's prescribed by a doctor and if it's dispensed through a licensed pharmacy. And those are two conditions that do not exist currently in the United States. So I do think that it does sort of put into question, well, you know, practicing Mormons in California or in Virginia, if are they still in good standing if they are using a cannabis product?
Yeah, Taylor Anderson, do you want to comment on that as well? I mean, the fact that this framework doesn't exist. We just have what is available in the states that have tried to do this piecemeal.
Right. And I did, after yesterday's announcement, I did talk to a couple of members who do use already. They were, again, anticipating this announcement. I called them up after it, and they said this was the best news possible for me. The church didn't come down against. They didn't say I'm a sinner for using. You know, they did add that conditional clause, but I think most members are highlighting on the first part of that sentence, we are okay with medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how all members take it.
You know, you'd think it would...
Robert Kirby is very happy right now.
Yeah, Robert Kirby.
That's
speaking,
right.
Speaking of Robert Kirby, stay tuned for a conversation with Robert Kirby a little later in the show about his use of medical marijuana. You know, you'd think that it would help to have a feasible alternative plan, you know, beyond the limited state plan that was passed last year for people who are terminally ill. Taylor, is that plan, or is there a future law? You talked about Marty Stevens working to sort of negotiate with the people who created Prop 2. Is something being hashed out right now behind closed doors somewhere? Do we know?
It's hard to say. They had their window, and now we're a little bit too close to the election. The governor has already said, I will not call a special session. That's how you would get something passed before voters weigh in on this. So now it's kind of up or down in November. After that, we'll see, you know, and we'll see if the legislature, if it fails, will the legislature still, you know, stick to this agreement that the coalition announced yesterday and, you know, work with proponents, work with kind of the framework of Proposition 2, but get it in a more medicinal pharmaceutical setting, you know, more like a you know, state-run pharmacy dispensary kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and see on that.
Can I add one thing from Taylor's coverage was the money angle? Tommy brought up that the church has a substantial clout. They had a lot of clout in the Prop 8 discussion in California. Now that they have come in, Taylor's earlier reporting was that Walter Plum was pretty much just financing the opposition to this medical marijuana initiative. Now, on the stage yesterday, we saw a lot of people, and there were a lot of names that people would recognize who are coming out in force. So will it equate to money? We've got Gail Miller. We've got Scott Anderson. We have Karen Huntsman, of course, disclosure. Her son Paul owns the newspaper. So will that mean an infusion of cash into the anti-campaign? And that really could be a turning point.
Yeah, I mean, the initiative itself is not going to change. As we've said, it can't. It is what it is. the church mustering support? I mean, you talked about those big names. Is that the result of the church mustering, mustering opposition to this initiative?
That's my take on it. Wow. I mean, when they came out, I'm assuming that others felt free to also come out and speak up.
Before we turn to other stories, I just want to, how rare is it for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to go that route, to go into the political arena and really throw its weight around? It seems like an unusual thing for a church to do.
Well, they've done it before in guns, in church houses. I mean, they had a pretty strong opposition to allowing concealed weapons in church houses. I think they're pretty selective. They don't come out all the time. There's a lot of backroom deals and conversations, but this kind of public display is a little bit unusual. Rare. Tommy?
No, I'm sorry. I just said publicly, because what would they do?
Right.
with you know, their lobbyists and such, we may not know necessarily, sure. Or we assume, but yes, thank you.
Good point, Tommy. Well, this fight is certainly going to go on, and we'll see what kind of campaigns, what kind of advertising is spent, what kind of money is thrown around between now and the November election. And Taylor Anderson, thanks for your reporting on this. I want to stick with you, actually, for a little bit longer and talk about the inland port, turned to a story that you covered also and have also been covering for a while. Subcommittees of the board working to develop the Utah inland port have been holding meetings, but for a very simple reason, they're getting some criticism. They're drawing the ire of some local residents. Tell us why people are unhappy with these meetings.
Well, because they probably are subject to the Utah's Open and Public Meetings Act. This is a semi-public, I mean, it's dealing with the biggest public, you know, economic development project in Utah's history. That's kind of a tagline that the governor and other supporters have issued this. These committees are dealing with some of the biggest questions that are out there to get this thing really rolling. Who the executive director is going to be and what qualifications should they have, what the business plan is going to be. That's something that, you know, opponents have been really honing in on, like, you know, should we have had that before we even passed the law to create this thing? One of these committees is focusing on the budget and the business plan. They've been holding meetings, at least one meeting so far. This topic came up and they said, you know, we're much more free to talk when, you know, we're just meeting just us. It's easier to set up these meetings and we're just going to go ahead as is. I'm guessing this will stay a topic of conversation, but for now they've been meeting behind closed doors.
So what is the justification they're using for meeting behind closed doors? You said that they may or probably are subject to the Open Meetings Act here in Utah. How are they doing this then?
Well, it depends on, you can get legal advice, whichever legal advice you need, you can get it from a different attorney. I talked to Jeff Hunt, who's kind of specializes on the Open and Public Meetings Act. He says that these are subject. The Attorney General has been advising the Inland Port Authority, and the Attorney General says, no, they are not. It really kind of depends how you read the statute. Go figure, it's a little bit loosey-goosey. And so in their eyes, we're not spending money. The board will spend money, and those will be public meetings. The subcommittees are just talking about issues, and so you know, until they spend a dime, they consider these to be closed justifiably.
Watchdog and journalism groups are upset about this. Obviously, they're saying these should be transparent.
Why would you have the conversations behind closed doors is what they're saying. I mean, you know, you're doing the public's business. This is the biggest project in Utah history. Nobody really on the Inland Port Board Authority really said, you know, there's any real advantages. Their argument was that, you know, according to the Open and Public Meetings Act, we don't have to open these, so why would we? And I said, well, is that, you know, is it just easier? Is it better for board members to have these discussions? Well, no, they said, it's just, why would we open them if we don't have to? So the argument isn't really there. The media groups, the SPJ came out and said, you know, please open these up. Everything operates better in sunlight.
Hmm. Jennifer, is there an argument that things, you know, can't get done when there's public scrutiny at every corner because there are so many different interests who might be at odds? And I mean, I could imagine that being a justification for trying to keep meetings, any meetings, private.
That's right. You know, democracy is messy and it's slow. And part of that is because you want a diversity of an opinion. You want you want things to be scrutinized fully. And, you know, I just find their excuse so ironic, because the new chair of that Inland Port Board Authority, Derek Miller, at his initial meeting, he acknowledged that so much secrecy surrounded the organization of the board that he was committed to openness and transparency. Then all of a sudden, these committees, they're not even subcommittee of subcommittee. They're three committees that we're talking about. They don't meet the requirements for a closed session. I just don't know why you wouldn't err on the side of caution and say, come on in. I mean, what do they have to hide?
Where do these meetings actually take place, Taylor Anderson? And are there minutes to the meetings? Is there any record of the meetings? I recognize also that having a public presence is something that people are advocating for. But can we find out what happened in these meetings?
That's a good question. I mean, the members of the committees have been talking openly about what was discussed. You can't really recreate a conversation that already happened, though. So on your other question, you know, will we be able to find out? Is there a public record? I don't know. That's a good question. Are they being recorded? Are they being staffed by state employees? I'm not sure. We should find out.
I'm wondering if this might be the push that impels somebody who has been threatening to sue over the bill and this project to do that. Could the city, for example, had threatened to sue. Some community groups and environmentalists had suggested that they might be suing over the Utah Inland Port. Is the Inland Port Board maybe shooting itself in the foot by doing this?
I don't know.
That's a leading question.
I'm not sure what the legal strategy will be. I would say that this probably wouldn't help their case, but again, I'm not a lawyer.
Right. Taylor, any change of policy coming here? I mean, is the Inland Port Board saying, you know, I mean, Jen pointed out that Derek Miller, the board chair, made some statements at the beginning of the first Inland Port or the first successful Inland Port board meeting. You know, might there be a change coming?
I think I've talked to board members that feel strongly enough about this that I feel fairly confident it will come up at a future board meeting and is yet to be decided. So okay. To be continued, I'd say.
Taylor, thanks for watching this and for reporting on it. And yeah, we'll keep an eye on it and see what happens, I guess. We need to head to another break, and when we come back, we'll probably turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay with us.
Arts reporting on Utah Public Radio is supported by the Office of the Executive Vice President and Provost, celebrating USU's Year of the Arts.
Climate One is a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. On our next program, we take a look at California's environmental leadership and how it has shaped conservation across the country.
The trees, the coast, the air, this is incredibly precious and impressive.
California Greenin on the next Climate One.
Join us Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evening.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Taylor Anderson, and Thomas Burr for our Friday morning news roundup. And it is time now to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight some news that maybe didn't make the cut for today's show or maybe didn't get a lot of play. And I will start with Taylor Anderson for your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yes, the Salt Lake County Republican Party has a new communications director, Dave Robinson. He's been a familiar face in county politics for a while. He came into the Tribune editorial board the other day, and Taylor Stevens has the story about some controversial remarks he made about what is causing a high suicide rate among Utah's LGBT community. It's worth reading.
Check it out at sltrib.com.
I was in the meeting. It was weird. It took a very strange turn. I highly recommend Taylor's reporting because it's definitely accurate. And we don't know what's going to happen to this guy now.
As a result of these statements.
As a result.
Yeah. Thomas Burr in Washington, your pick for Underplayed Story.
You know, lost in all the Manafort and Cohen news, all this Trump stuff that's happened this week, the indictment of a California congressman, Duncan Hunter, is just amazing. Go read the indictment. It's almost hilarious how he is alleged to have misused, hilarious and sad, he misused hundreds of thousands of dollars of campaign money for personal use, including one point where he and his wife had no money. They had like $36 in the bank account. He withdraws the $20 he can, but he wants to go buy Hawaiian shirts, and so his wife suggests, well, just, say they were golf balls to help wounded warriors. It's just amazing how they got away with this.
Okay, wow. Thomas Burr's interesting pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. I'll check that out for certain. I did not hear that story. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Gosh, it's a toss-up for me. I have two that I'm very personally invested in that are actually in today's Tribune, sltrib.com. Utah State University employees. We got some documents from them last night as part of a settlement agreement that we reached with Utah State. So we've been fighting this legal battle for more than 2 years, trying to find out a little bit more about the circumstances, how the campus handled the Torrey Greene case. We've seen alleged abuse in the piano department recently. And so this is a big win for the public. Wow. So check out that story. The other one is just really depressing. The wages for women in Utah have gone down. We have actually gone down. We're now the lowest in the United States. And I think it's such a black mark on our community. We got to do something about that.
Despite a lot of public scrutiny and a lot of, intent to do something about that, that is disheartening. Mine kind of plays into that as well. Utah, according to a new study, this is a story that Aaron Alberti reported on. Utah is the second most sexist state in the union, according to researchers. And part of the problem they identified was internalized sexist attitudes from Utah women. Check out the story at sltrib.com. And, you can learn more there. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Taylor Anderson, Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We are going to wrap up this week with a special segment that touches on something that we covered earlier in the show. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as we mentioned, announced its opposition to medical marijuana ballot initiative that's coming up this November. They did that this week. But last week, Tribune columnist Robert Kirby wrote about his own experience as a user of medical cannabis and as a Mormon. KCBW's Emily Means sat down with Kirby to talk about his experience.
Kirby, we are talking today about your experience with medical marijuana as a church-going member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you're a special kind of person, as it is anyway. But do you think that you're the only one, the only Mormon who uses medical cannabis?
I know I'm not.
You know that?
I know for a fact.
Do you think the Mormon community, or maybe you can talk about your Mormon community, your ward specifically, do they have any particular sense of this?
My ward, not so much. I mean, to have Robert Kirby in your ward is to be a little bit nervous. All right.
So they think you're going to write a story about
them.
They
don't want to end up being famous. And so most of my experience in terms of other Mormons that use medical marijuana, it comes from friends that are mm-hmm. scattered throughout the valley and things like that. One of the things people tend to forget is that when Prohibition was repealed, mm-hmm. Utah was the vote that pushed it over. It was
to repeal Prohibition.
Right.
Utahns.
So Utah. And Utahns were told by church leaders, do not do this. Mm-hmm. But Mormons voted overwhelmingly to repeal Prohibition.
Well, how does someone with your background, I mean, you're an ex-cop, you're a religious person, how does someone like you decide to try cannabis for pain management?
Part of it stemmed from the fact that I'd had a number of surgeries that required opioids. And after a year and a half, I was fully addicted to them and hated being a slave not only to the drug, but also to the pain that I would have to suffer if I stopped taking them. And I couldn't do it anymore. I mean, I couldn't think on them. Opioids were just bad for me. And so I was looking for alternative ways to deal with the pain. And coincidentally, right about that time, the medical marijuana initiative was starting to gain traction in Utah. And the Tribune wanted to know things about, say, the dispensaries in Colorado. How was it done? How was it delivered, you know, managed, and that sort of thing. So they sent me to Colorado.
They sent you on assignment.
They sent me on assignment, right. Go find out about weed.
And what'd you find out?
Well, I found out that it's a hell of a lot different than it was in high school. That's for sure. And I found out that there was actually some merit to it. The problem is that you really can't self-diagnose without paying a lot of money to figure out what works.
Okay, and you're talking about kind of in terms of products, what products work for you?
Right. I mean, there's vaping, there's edibles, there is cream that you can rub on yourself, the parts of you that hurt or whatever. And I tried them all. I mean, it was in Colorado, it was legal. And I ultimately concluded that the best way to go for me was the cream because, well, I'm not going to presume that you've tried weed yourself, but it is extremely hard to write when you're high. And so I couldn't do that.
And so the cream doesn't give you that kind of high.
No, you don't. I don't know anybody that I've talked to of my fellow weed cream users who get high from it. No.
And this, just to be clear, this is not an endorsement happening here on the radio right now. But,
yeah.
You know, you're talking about figuring out what works for you yourself as a patient. And the church officially came out against the medical cannabis ballot initiative, Proposition 2. But it said it wouldn't object to medical cannabis being prescribed by a doctor and obtained from a licensed pharmacy. So if that had been the case, you know, would you have been able to figure out what worked for you?
Yeah, I mean, you would have somebody who had some experience with patients, you know, some training and to know what to do with it. Because let's be really clear, I'm not advocating the recreational use of marijuana. We have enough problems on our freeways with people who are on their cell phones or drunk or whatever. We don't need more. But I am advocating the use of marijuana as a pain-relieving drug or something that, you know, frees you from epilepsy or whatever, in my particular case, it's pain, that isn't addictive, and opioids are.
What does it mean to you as a Mormon for the church to come out and say they're not opposed to medical marijuana just the way that this ballot initiative has interpreted it?
I think that they're on the right track, but I think that they need to be more outspoken about supporting a product that doesn't get people addicted. The research needs to go forward on this, and we need it to have it available to people who seek an alternative to those other more, you know, genuinely lethal drugs.
So we're kind of talking about this in terms of the intersection of marijuana and religion. And there's also a lawsuit by Drug Safe Utah, Walter Plum from Drug Safe Utah. And he says, as a Mormon, that the passage of this initiative would infringe upon his religious freedoms, including the right not to consort with people engaging in activities which their religion finds repugnant. Do you think that, I mean, you're a Mormon and you've talked to different people in your community. Is this something that a lot of people agree with, that it's infringing upon their religious freedoms?
I'm trying to think of some way to respond to this question without using profanity.
But we're on the radio.
That's ridiculous. And it's bigoted. I don't hear that coming from a lot of Mormons. I mean, Mormons come in various types, okay? Open-minded Mormons, liberal Mormons, staunch Mormons, Orthodox Mormons, Nazi Mormons. And you're always going to get somebody who is so terrified of demon weed that they'll resort to this sort of thing. But most people, most Mormons that I know, say the ones I actually in my ward, have a more of a wait and see attitude. They would like some control over it. And anybody who wants medical marijuana wants that control to be there, because you get quality control for starters, you get the research into it for another thing, and you know what you're being prescribed because somebody has done the legwork. And most Mormons would get behind that, I believe.
Do you think it comes down to, for some people, you know, that the drug is illegal at the federal level and, you know, it's immoral to do illegal things? Or is there more to it than that?
No, hell, the church has a history of doing illegal things. I mean, our religion is based on doing illegal things.
Rebellion.
Yeah, rebellion. I mean, polygamy. We go all the way back. You can find Mormons breaking federal laws left and right. I think most of it, most of the reluctance stems from the fact, well, let me add a caveat here, that some Mormons believe what they're told so much by church authorities that they automatically side that way. But other Mormons who give it a little bit more thought can see the actual benefits to it and don't look at it as immoral or like myself. I'm breaking the law by using this cream right here, but I don't believe it's an immoral thing. I believe it's immoral to keep pain relief and medicine away from people who need it.
Okay. Well, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, thanks for joining me.
You bet.
And again, that was Tribune columnist Robert Kirby in conversation with KCPW producer Emily Means, talking about his use of medical marijuana to treat chronic pain. Kirby also wrote a column about this that you can find at sltrib.com. That wraps up this edition of Behind the Headlines, and thanks very much to our operations and programming director, Jesse Ellis, to the good folks at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and to our intrepid producer, Emily Means. Coming up next on KCPW Presents, at least here on KCPW, that is an Intelligence Squared debate on globalization and trade liberalization. You can check that out next here on KCPW. Find our local podcasts at our website, kcpw.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter and on other social feeds as well. Just check us out at kcpw.org to find out more. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks very much for tuning in to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Tune in next week to learn more. Thanks very much.
This week on Undisciplined, we're talking about two of the most fundamental essentials on the human hierarchy of needs, food and water. And we'll be joined by two scientists who have discovered there's a whole lot we still have to learn about how those things impact our world and our lives. That's Undisciplined, Friday at 2.
I'm Jessica Nani, the social media and web management intern here at Utah Public Radio. While I don't do much reporting on the air, I have the pleasure of interacting with you, our listeners, on the web to help bring stories to you from beyond the air. Check us out on upr.org, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and on our app for news updates, community event information, award-winning feature series, and much more. If you have any content requests, we'd love to hear them using the hashtag IAmUPR. And as always, thanks for listening.
The main reason I love Bullseye is because Jesse Thorne is genuinely interested in establishing a ground of conversation with his guests.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, comedian, TV host, and Emmy winner W. Kamau Bell. Plus, Mike Pesca, the host of Slate's The Gist podcast, has a new book out. It's called Upon Further Review. It's all on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Ridgefield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.